This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. This Sunday, thousands of cyclists will begin a week-long trek from San Francisco to Los Angeles to raise money for HIV/AIDS services. It's the AIDS Life Cycle event. It's happened every year since 1993. Esther Kim has done that 550-mile bike ride five times. And Kim's athleticism is not just reserved for a bike. Kim's 45 years old. She's run in seven marathons, competed in an Ironman, and two half Ironmans. One more thing about her physicality, she's also HIV positive. There are roughly 60,000 Angelenos living with HIV today. And unlike Esther, most of them are men. Many of those men are Black or Latino, and gay or bisexual. Now, there are organizations working with those men and trying to eradicate new HIV cases here in LA County. We're going to hear more about that in a moment. But first, Esther's story. Despite huge medical advances in HIV treatment, there is still stigma surrounding the disease. And that stigma was so strong for Kim, she actually refused to acknowledge the disease until it almost killed her. Now, Kim has come a long way in the near 20 years since she was diagnosed. And now, she's actually a media ambassador for AIDS Life Cycle.
I'm grateful that I found my voice, that I can talk about my status and not feel ashamed.
Kim told her story to KCRW's Jenny Hamill at her home in Glassell Park.
So I just finished graduate school. I was traveling. I was young. I met someone and we started dating. He moved to the States. We were together. We got engaged. And then the engagement didn't last too long. We broke up. And then I think a couple months after we broke up, he called me from his country and told me he was HIV positive. So then I actually got a free test and the results were ambiguous. So they had me go to a free clinic. So I went there and my test results came out positive. More than anything, I was afraid because at the time I was a single mom of a five-year-old. So my main concern was what's going to happen to me in terms of how it relates to my son. I mean, there are other things I was thinking about too, but I think that was my main concern.
Kim was consumed by the fear of leaving her son motherless, but she didn't run out and seek treatment. That's because she had another crushing fear, that anyone would find out she had the disease.
You know, I postponed treatment for a long time. I would see the doctor, but I refused medication because I was worried someone would discover it. And so my T cells dropped below 200, which means you have AIDS. And until it was forced on me, I wouldn't take them. And that was based off of fear that someone would find out or someone would find them and ask, what are those?
So you were willing to allow yourself to be so immunocompromised because you didn't want to take the meds.
So before I did go on the meds, I got really sick and had to go to the emergency room. And they wanted to check me in because I was really sick. And at that point, no one knew I was HIV positive. And I didn't know how I would explain that, so I was refusing admittance. And the ER doctor was the one who convinced me. He's like, no, you really have to stay. And so I checked in. I was there for a week. They put me on medication, and that's when I started.
Kim didn't have health insurance at the time, so she applied for the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which helps Californians with HIV who fall below a certain income level get the meds they need. Now her health was stabilizing, but that other fear of letting people know was just as debilitating. She was raised in a Korean Christian household and worried about being accepted by her family.
I told my sister, and then I told one of my brothers. And it was interesting because their response, I mean, they are very loving, very supportive, we're very close. But knowing, understanding my parents, they're like, don't ever tell them. They're like, just let them die without ever knowing. And so, I mean, that's how I thought I would be too. Like, I just didn't want to add any stress to their lives. I didn't want to cause any drama. I didn't want somehow the church to find out. I don't even go to their church. I haven't gone since I was like 21. But somehow, because the Korean community is so close-knit in Los Angeles, that I just, you know, your imagination goes wild. And I think, oh, if one person finds out, then all Korean people will find out. And then it'll get back to my parents.
And did you not want to bring shame on them? Was that one of the motivations? Is that a concern?
That was actually, I think that was my main motivation. Well, my main one was I didn't want my parents to feel hurt. And then on top of that, I didn't want them to be shamed because of me. And like in my early 20s, I had a child and I chose not to get married. So that was in itself really bad. I mean, it was
another thing.
Yeah. So for me, it felt like, oh my gosh, there's this other thing that I would put them through.
About 10 years ago, Kim started tapping into her physical and spiritual strength. She also found her way to AIDS Project Los Angeles.
It wasn't planned. But within 1 year, I started therapy. I was training for my first marathon, and I went back to church. The marathon training was intense because I am not a runner. I've never done anything like that before. And because it was specifically for APLA, I met a bunch of other people who were HIV positive or were running in the memory of someone they lost. And I got to hear a lot of people's stories. And even though I didn't have the courage to share my story, I was starting to hear conversations about it. And I wasn't so isolated. And then the therapy was super helpful because she helped me sort through the whole thing.
Kim has yet to meet another straight Korean woman living with HIV, but she's found connection and acceptance in other ways. She's become more outspoken about her own illness. 2 years ago, after 16 years with the disease, Kim finally told her parents she had HIV, but there's still so much stigma.
A few years ago, I actually, my friend from the marathon group, her cousin passed away from AIDS. And it was sad because he's not Asian. He was Hispanic. And he had a hard time telling his family. And so rather than sharing it with his family, he kept it a secret. And because he kept it a secret, it caused him to make a lot of choices that didn't allow him to take care of himself properly. So he ended up dying from it. And to me, that's so sad. It was so unnecessary because we do have medication that's available. It's expensive, but it's available.
He could have lived.
Kim takes a cocktail of 3 medications every day at 8 o'clock.
The thing with medication is, I mean, people now, like my son, he doesn't think HIV is such a big deal, you know, because they didn't grow up the way we grew up with it. He's like, oh, you just take some medicine and you're fine. I was like, no, it's more than that.
As Kim explains, there's a set amount of medications that exist for those who are HIV positive. So you have to take them consistently. You can't miss a dose or the virus will build up against the medication. Then you'd have to move on to the next medicine. And ultimately, you could run out of options. But beyond that, Esther Kim says she's doing great. She's married. Her son just graduated college. She works as a background painter in the animation industry. And besides taking the meds daily, Kim says the disease doesn't really affect her physically. She's now undetectable, which means the level of HIV in her body is so low that it's untransmittable to others. And now, rather than hiding her status, she's being vocal.
I think more than anything, I'll never forget how I felt those early years. How alone I felt. You know, I created these walls around myself and didn't really let anybody in because I was so scared. And I also made some mistakes based on fear. Some of my choices weren't the best. And if by sharing my story, it can help the next person who is in that same situation? Because I'm sure there are many, many other people who feel that way, that, you know, just give them a little bit of hope and kind of normalize it and not make it so evil or so negative.
That was Esther Kim speaking with KCRW's Jenny Hamill, and Jenny now joins us in the studio. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Steve.
So we all know, Jenny, that HIV can affect pretty much anyone, but Esther Kim is a straight 45-year-old Asian woman, and she's not representative of many of the people who are still getting this disease today, right?
That's right. About 60,000 people in Los Angeles County have HIV, and there are roughly 1,700 to 2,000 new cases every year. The people who are getting the disease at the highest rates are young, gay and bisexual, Black and Latino men, and members of the trans community. I talked to a man named Lestian McNeil, who works at the Black AIDS Institute, which is an organization aimed at ending the HIV/AIDS epidemic, specifically in Black communities. He got the disease back in 2012 when he was in his early 20s. He lives and works here in LA. Now, in terms of identity, he's different from Esther Kim, but the role that stigma against HIV and against being gay played in his life isn't that different.
I was a young Black gay man in South Carolina, just actually graduated college. I was working as a bartender at the time. And so my identity at the time was still deeply set in, you know, trying to maintain Southern, quote unquote, norms of, you know, not being openly gay. Or up until that point, I had always been told that being gay was a death sentence and that it was such a deviation from the norm as to be thought of as unacceptable. And I still operated in that space up until a few years ago, honestly. And I think that significantly impacted my ability to protect myself against HIV, but also took a toll on just my overall mental and physical well-being. I don't know that we ever talk about the weight of hiding one's identity and how that impacts a person's decisions and health outcomes.
McNeil says at the time he didn't realize he could take PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, a medicine people who are at really high risk of getting HIV can take every day to lower their chances of getting infected. And he thinks the same types of barriers that existed for him as a young man in the South exist for young men even here in LA. So now he's working with those populations. He wants to eradicate the disease.
Well, I mean, what does that mean, though, Jenny? I mean, like the way we used to think of measles not existing in the U.S. anymore, getting rid of them completely?
You could say that. I mean, essentially, the thought is this. If no one gives it to anyone else, eventually no one will have the disease anymore. Now, I spoke to Rania Copeland, who's the president of the Black AIDS Institute, who says that we have the tools today to end the epidemic.
We know how to test people in a really kind of quick manner. We have amazing surveillance data that shows us down to the zip code where new HIV infections are happening, and modeling that can show us, you know, if you can identify X number of people who are newly diagnosed with HIV, get them to care, that, you know, that will ultimately kind of end an epidemic in a local city or in a community. We also have amazing medications, new biomedical advances that have really kind of shaped this kind of phrase around ending the epidemic.
So what Copeland's talking about there is PrEP and people like Esther, who, because they're on these medications, taking them diligently, their viral load is undetectable and they can't spread the disease. In California, Copeland says poverty really shouldn't be an impediment to access to HIV medication at all. She says there's a really strong safety net in the state where one can get medication through Medicaid. Even those who are undocumented should be able to get medicines through a patient support program provided through the state or even the pharmaceutical companies that make these medicines.
All right, so with all those things happening, right, all those things that are good news in trying to get rid of the disease, why hasn't it been eradicated?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, Steve. The Black AIDS Institute do have a lot of people coming into their clinic in MacArthur Park to get tested for HIV who are homeless and don't have access to medical care, or there are individuals dealing with mental health issues. They might be dealing with drug abuse. There's a lot of meth out there these days. There's also men coming out of prison that might have been exposed to HIV. And just like in South Carolina, being gay or bisexual or trans That is largely stigmatized in the Black community. So if you are LGBTQ, you may lose the stability of housing, lose access to resources and support. You might not be keeping yourself informed about what doctors or medicine is out there.
So given all of that, is it realistic then to imagine HIV going away completely? Or do you think that's pie in the sky?
Well, actually, I mean, the obstacles are out there, but there are cities making huge advances. Like San Francisco. The city started its Getting to Zero campaign in 2014 with the goal of reaching a near zero new HIV infections by 2020. And it's being really recognized as potentially being the first city to eradicate all new cases of HIV. We know that LA County has a plan to combat HIV as well. So maybe it will look like that someday as well.
And in San Francisco, 2020, by the way, is next year.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there's work to be done.
Yeah. KCRW's Jenny Hamill. Jenny, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, what are your thoughts? Is LA doing enough to combat HIV and AIDS? Share your thoughts with us. I'm at Radio Chio and hashtag Greater LA. Coming up on the program, what on earth is going on at Santa Anita? Another horse has died at the track, and it is a race against time to find out why. An update coming up next on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Something is causing horses to get injured at Santa Anita Racetrack in Arcadia. 26 of the animals have had to be euthanized since just before the beginning of the year. And this past holiday weekend, a 9-year-old gelding named Cochise was put down after getting injured during a race. He was the third horse to die just in the past 2 weeks. Now, those deaths have made the decades-old track the target of withering criticism and prompted calls to shut it down. But despite what's going on, a lot of people still love Santa Anita. And KCRW's Saul Gonzalez spent some time there recently with fans of the sport and track for this juxtaposition, right, of tragedy with the sport of horse racing. He went there during the early morning hours before dawn when tractors smooth down the track before the horses come out. Horse race aficionados gather to watch the thoroughbreds and jockeys train as the first rays of dawn slowly spread across the dirt track. People such as Kathy Sullivan and her friend Bob Goodell, who talked to Saul as the horses ran through their paces.
Do you like this scene out here early morning in Santa Anita?
Divine. It is my divine haven. Gosh. There's no place like this. It's an Eden.
It's really more than that. Just to sit here and watch the sun come up and watch the palm trees rise up out of the, literally out of the mountains. It's unbelievable.
And then when you come out here as people who ride, who know the sport, what are you looking for as these magnificent animals whiz by?
I'm looking at the artistry and the skill level of these jockeys, these exercise jockeys, to be able to control those horses, make them move the way they do. And the horses are so athletic, so built, so full of shine. It's a privilege to watch the combo.
As someone who loves the sport, who loves the animals, who loves the jockeys, what do you think about what's been happening here at the track?
I am hopeful. I am hopeful that out of the tragedies, and there have been many tragedies, heartaches, a lot of people suffered through this because of the closing, the need to close the track, the families. I am hopeful that people are collaborating together to be honest about what the issues are, and that working together, that we will all be better for it, and that horse racing will be better for it. Because if you don't have that integrity, it's going to collapse. Racing's going to collapse.
That was horse lover Kathy Sullivan speaking with KCRW's Saul Gonzalez at Santa Anita. Saul joins me now in the studio. Hi, Saul.
Hey, Steve.
So Kathy hopes for the best at Santa Anita. She thinks that if the track doesn't find a way to stop those deaths, it could jeopardize the sport. Remind us why so many horses have died.
Well, Steve, the horses have typically been injured during the actual races. Some people blame all the recent rains we've had in Southern California. They say that's made the track really, really soft, softer than usual. But when a sealant's been put on the track to keep the water off, some then say it's become too hard on the horses. Others point to perhaps racing practices that are too grueling and the overuse of medication, particularly a drug called Lasix that's very commonly used at racetracks. I spoke with another racing fan at the track. His name is Bob Dawkins, and I asked him what he thinks has been happening the last couple of months.
Well, what happens in every track, horses break down, okay? They have the most frailest legs in the world, okay? And they're a ton, okay? So all that weight, but they don't know what's causing all the breakdown. But every track has this problem, you know?
And Mr. Dawkins is right. I mean, he's been coming to the track since the 1980s, and horse deaths continue to occur at other tracks, but never in this kind of contracted period of time, right? That is what's so unusual. If there had been one or two horse deaths, say, the past year at Santa Anita, obviously, I don't think it would have attracted nearly this much attention. But so many horses dying or being put down, rather, in such a contracted period of time, it is very, very bizarre and sad and tragic.
Who owns this track, and what have they done to reduce the deaths, or what are they doing right now?
Well, the owners, it's a company called the Stronach Group. The Stronachs are really well known in the racing world. They own, besides Santa Anita, tracks in Northern California, Oregon, Florida, Maryland. It also owns a kind of retirement facility for thoroughbreds once they age out of the sport. I should say there's actually an ugly family feud right now, like something out of a nighttime soap opera within the family, with the patriarch of the family squared off against some of his kids. But when it comes to protecting the horses at Santa Anita itself, the Stronach Company says it's doing everything possible to ensure the safety of these really valuable animals by limiting the use of drugs, monitoring training sessions much more closely. And there's a proposal even to phase out the riding crop, which, of course, jockeys use to whip horses during races. We at KCRW have reached out to the company to visit the stable area at Santa Anita, but so far we haven't gotten a response.
Yeah, I know. They're probably towing this line, right? Trying to straddle this line, as it were, because they keep headlining the news with all these horse deaths, but at the same time, we sure do need to hear their side of the story, hear what they're having to say about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a sport that, you know, could really live or die on public opinion. It's already a sport that's been in decline in recent years in this country, and essentially it does not need this kind of bad news.
Earlier this year, Senator Dianne Feinstein called for the suspension of racing at Santa Anita until these investigations are complete. What else are critics saying or doing?
Well, on race days now at Santa Anita, you will usually see a small group of protesters just outside the track holding up signs, and they're calling, well, specifically for the end of racing at Santa Anita for good, and more generally, the end of racing in the United States. I should note, though, Steve, that there has been a bit of good news for Santa Anita this week. PETA, or the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, said all tracks across the country should adopt Santa Anita's new safety protocols as a model. So you have this really unusual alliance now between the owners of the Santa Anita track and PETA, this, you know, what is some is a more militant animal rights group, kind of joining forces, least when it comes to safety protocols at Santa Anita and the need for other tracks to possibly start looking into those protocols and adopting them for themselves.
And meanwhile, Saul, the horses continue to race.
Yeah, the racing season continues until June 23rd. Then the next race will be the Breeders' Cup World Championship in November. That's considered one of the sport's biggest competitions, with about $28 million in prizes. So, despite these deaths, the sport continues to attract fans and money, and people still go to the track.
And the focus right now, the spotlight is on Santa Anita.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people are saying whatever happens to Santa Anita, that might seal the fate of the horse race industry in this country.
Mm. KCRW, Saul Gonzalez. Saul, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
That's Greater LA for today. Tomorrow on the program, street and sidewalk sweeping means different things to different people. When it is your belongings being swept up, the only items in your possession, it can make a terrible situation much, much worse. That's tomorrow on the show. I hope you will join us. Coming up next, all the president's lawyers, Josh Barrow and Ken White. Bob Mueller gave voice today to his report on Russian election meddling. What does it mean going forward? Will it nudge more Democrats, maybe even some Republicans, toward impeachment? The discussion just ahead. Thanks, as always, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christian Bordahl for making this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis, again, at Radio Chio on Twitter. Thanks for your ear. Have a great day. And let's do it tomorrow.